Good morning, diners and travelers. Another edition of On the Menu with Ann and Peter Haig. And we're going to be talking to some...
Oh, boy, this is the third new script in 3 weeks.
Oh, my. Amazing.
Getting everybody confused.
Well, we have some really excited people yet again. As I've said over and over again, this is the joy of producing On the Menu, is we get to talk to old friends, we get to meet new friends, and a whole bunch of interesting people circle around the culinary orbits. And is that the right thing?
Yeah, I suppose.
Circle and orbit.
And first up is a new friend, although he feels like an old friend.
Yeah,
we had
Ethan.
Such a wonderful chat with him. Ethan Stoll, who owns several restaurants in Seattle, including one called How to Eat a Wolf. And he sounds like just such a fine fellow. We're looking forward to meeting him in person. But in the meantime, we had a chance to talk to him about his approach to cooking as embodied in his cuisine, but also now embodied in a cookbook just released. So here's Ethan Stoll from Seattle.
I just told our next guest, Ethan Stoll, that his book, The New Italian Kitchen, as soon as I got it, I wanted to hop on a plane and fly to Seattle to just eat this food. It is so good looking and it's just so inspired, Ethan. Tell us, you own four restaurants. Explain to our listeners what they are.
Hey, we've got four restaurants in Seattle. The first one is Tavolata, which is a very rustic, casual pasta joint down in Belltown, our downtown location. Then we've got three other ones in the neighborhoods. So How to Cook a Wolf, which is on top of Queen Anne. It's our small plates, kind of casual, bounce-in-and-out restaurant. Then Anchovies and Olives is our seafood restaurant, all Italian-inspired seafood, so there's no meat on the menu. And then Staple and Fancy Mercantile is the place I work the most, down in a neighborhood called Ballard.
Oh, yeah.
And it's kind of a chef-inspired restaurant, where basically you don't know what's coming.
Now, the estate of MFK Fisher didn't sue you for the name How to Cook a Wolf?
Nope. Nope, they haven't yet.
you better not be too successful. You never can tell.
Yeah, I try to avoid it. It's a fine line.
Don't open one called Julia Child, whatever you do.
Okay.
Yeah, now you've selected the Pacific Northwest primarily because of the accessibility of so many fabulous ingredients. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, two things. Firstly, I'm from here. So it's my hometown, so I have a deep connection that way. And the other one is you're cooking and you travel around and you kind of come back to what you think is the best, and I kind of found that my neighborhood was the best. There's no better place in the world for things like mushrooms and fiddlehead ferns and wild watercress and apples and pears, shellfish, oysters, clams, mussels, crab, gooey duck. So, you do what's there, and you do what you love, and you do what you think is great. And we have such a great bounty of things here that I didn't really see any need to go anywhere else.
Now, why Italian, Ethan? Ethan's not Italian. Stoll's not Italian. Is there some Italian buried there that we just don't see?
Actually, there's not. Traveling there has been always great. Loving the style of dining was the main thing, and the style of eating. For me, I grew up in a household where we had dinner family style around the table every night. It was very important to my parents to have all their kids eating around a table together and conversing and laughing and yelling, whatever you had to do.
Everybody did that, and the more I talk to people, I realize how many people don't do that anymore.
It doesn't happen as much as you think it does. And for us, it was definitely a regimented thing. There was no option. So in that, it was the family style dining was kind of instilled in me. And then it was kind of learning how to cook and learning what style of food you liked. And I kept on going back to family style. I kept on going back to pasta. I kept on going back to fresh ingredients. And all of that, to me, says Italian food. Fresh ingredients, simply made, served family style, taken care of but not fussed over too much, basically all about ingredients.
And you say that the proudest thing for wheat is to become pasta.
I think so.
Now, you said that your book is very seasonal, which it is, and you were expressing some misgivings about people's perception of that. I think that it's perfect.
Well, I think perfect. I mean, there are a lot of books out there that don't necessarily call for things you can't get all the time. Morel mushrooms, ramp, chanterelles. There are some, but, our approach to this book was we want it to be a very approachable book, and we want it to be a fun book. But we want people to understand that you have to go to your farmer's market to cook out of this book. That's what you have to do. You can't go to QFC. You can't go to Whole Foods for the most part. You can't do all those things.
You just can't get the ingredients. They're just not there.
But you encourage foraging.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Know where your stuff comes from.
Yeah,
go get yourself. It's great.
Tell my husband that because we have a wonderful backyard garden full of weeds. It makes wonderful salad.
Yeah, she keeps on serving me what I call sticks.
I think everybody right now has a backyard of weeds and not much at all. I'm looking at mine right now, and it's seen better days.
Well, at least maybe it's not under snow. Ours is under snow. I planted some spinach about 3 or 4 weeks ago, and hoping that it might come up, and I think it's just gone bye-byes.
Ours is all frosted over.
Yeah, exactly. Now, the amazing thing was that last year we got 4 feet of snow all at once.
That's not. And, I'm thankful we don't get that out here.
Well, it's a once in a couple of centuries thing here in Pittsburgh. But when it all melted away, the Swiss chard that had been growing in the fall was growing again in the spring.
That's great.
And it's still growing a little bit now. I think it stopped because the frost got it. So we'll see if it comes back.
Now you write this with a good dose of wit and humor, even in the title of your sections. The first, I guess they're small plates, apps, are nibbles and bits. And then you have the measure of a cook, soups. Now, why is that a measure of a cook?
It's one of those things, I don't know where it started, but soup has kind of been one of my pet peeves in the kitchen. I think a cook can make good soup is talented and understands cooking. There's so many times you've been in the kitchen or worked in a restaurant where, say you're making potato leek soup. They cook it and cook it and cook it and cook it and cook it, and then you say, why are you cooking it so much? I say, well, it's just going to be puree. What difference does it make? It's like, well, okay, let's put it this way. Would you want to cook your green beans for your green bean salad as long as you did that? Why are you, there's no need to overcook soup.
Uh-huh.
You cook soup to the proper doneness, you puree it, you strain it, you cool it down as quick as possible because all that flavor stays in there. It tastes like a fresh soup. All the nutrients stay in there. So soups, people, I think it's oftentimes I've seen it as an afterthought, and people don't understand exactly how beautiful a soup can be.
Oh, you have wonderful soups here. You have two soups with artichoke. You have, like, the one that I was drooling over when we first said hello was the Mediterranean mussel, which is a very succulent mussel, and chickpea soup with fennel and lemon.
And find fresh chickpeas if you can. Boy, that's quite a search, I think.
Yeah,
they're coming more, they're definitely being more readily available in the spring. And, it's a little bit more work, but, a beautiful soup is amazing. Absolutely amazing.
We saw some chickpeas growing on trees.
In Abruzzo.
We were in Abruzzo, and they're the strangest looking things. They don't look anything like what you'd expect when they come out of a can.
No.
I don't know, we used to have dried chickpeas at home growing up.
Yeah, dried reconstituted chickpeas would be very good. You remember those wonderful beans we got from a place called Leonforte in central Sicily? Absolutely wonderful, giant fava-type beans.
Yeah, probably like the Corona bean.
Similar to that, I think. The sad part about it is,
work.
But we realized that you had to shell them all. This is about a kilo of dried beans, and we shelled them all, and then we were making a dish of something. I forget what it was. So we decided we would add. They essentially broke down into the broth. Tasted really good, but it was such a lot of work getting the skins off.
You just have to close your eyes as you're eating.
Yeah. because they tasted so wonderful.
So and then moving on here, you have starches to grow on, which is the gnocchi, polenta, risotto, and farrotto. And then you have what I was talking to you about before, is wheat's highest calling is pasta. And you make all of yours from scratch, huh?
Definitely all of ours from scratch. I wanted to call that chapter Wheat's Highest Calling. So, I think there's one of those, I think pasta is one of those things that definitely over the last, 5 years has made a little bit of a resurgence. There's definitely a little bit more of a respect for pasta than there was for maybe like a 10-year gap. It seemed like to me there was that big craze about fine French food, and I was still making gnocchi and spaghetti, which I think is great. I mean, it's one of those things that pasta to me is, if you have a nice bowl of spaghetti with great olive oil, fresh garlic, some nice salted anchovies, and a little bit of chili, and you're great. As good as it gets, right there.
Well, from traveling in Italy, that most Italians wouldn't consider a meal complete without pasta.
Right.
Now, when you get to your meat section, you have an interesting observation, I think. I think it's interesting. You say that your favorite meat is a big, fat, juicy ribeye. And this seems to run a little bit counter to some of the trend stuff we've been getting, that people are saying you should eat less meat, you shouldn't get great slabs of meat like we used to get. I mean, how do you respond to that?
My response to that is I'm not eating a ribeye every day.
Okay.
Every once in a while, to that family atmosphere I was talking about is that sitting down with people and having a mind-blowing carnivorous experience at times is fun. I don't think you should eat meat every day. I don't think it's healthy. Probably eat steak. Probably I would average you know, maybe once a month, really. I mean, I eat pasta for the most part, a lot of salads, a lot of soup, a ton of seafood, especially in the wintertime when all our shellfish out here is great. But, you know, something like that, it's fun for people to get together and suck all the fat off the bone and get every last bit. It's enjoyable.
I love your skate recipe and the way you talk about skate as being absolutely the most delicious fish.
Oh, I missed that.
A lot of people will never touch it. Our local Whole Foods market can get it, but they don't ever bring it in. I really get very annoyed with them.
Penn Avenue fish market will get it.
We both absolutely love it. I mean, we think it is exactly the way you describe it.
And I always cook it on the bone myself. You know, I mean, take it off the bone and then sear it that way. I have to eat off the bone.
I like the texture.
So much more flavor.
Yeah, and I like the texture of it too.
Yeah, we had a recipe for skate wings from a British chef called Rick Stein that I've adapted to lots of other kinds of fish as well, but it'd be great to get skate more often if we could.
Yeah, it's definitely a fish that's been overfished quite a bit for byproduct stuff.
Oh, is that what's happened? So that's one of the reasons it's not so available?
Well, it's not so much available. It's definitely a seasonal thing, and they're definitely starting to regulate it a little bit more, which is good. We've got West Coast skate that's definitely very well regulated out here. The East Coast stuff isn't as much, but it's still, they're starting to learn, which is good.
Now, I think we should mention the fact that these are fairly unusual recipes, and you mentioned before, you like to give even home cooks a nudge to a challenge. And so, like, you have braised pork jowls with maligned mélange, which is pretty funny. And again, and home-cured bacon. How many people cure their bacon at home?
I don't know. It's not as hard as people think. Putting it on cure for a little bit, drying it out for a little bit, and putting it in the smoker until it gets to a certain temperature. It's really no different than cooking a piece of steak or baking a pork roast or anything like that.
But listeners, be aware the recipe calls for an input of 9 pounds of pork belly.
There is that, yeah.
So, which
can be scaled, though.
Which makes it hard.
I mean, we're just assuming everyone likes bacon as much as I do.
Well, we actually do, but I'm still not sure, but maybe I'd better make that one.
Yeah, it's great. You know, if you get a pork belly in and cure it, smoke it, then let it cool down, and then cut it in pieces, wrap it in plastic wrap, put it in your freezer.
Exactly.
And you have homemade pork belly for months.
Oh, Ethan, here's the funny one. Bob hit squid is pretty funny.
Some of the titles we definitely tried to make sure people understood that we don't, you know, we take our techniques and how we cook things and how we handle our products seriously, but we don't take ourselves that seriously. We want people, when they come into these restaurants, to understand that we're here to have fun. We're here to make you a good meal. We're here to have fun with you. We're here to laugh with you. We're here to enjoy our time together. And we don't want you to think that we're this temple of haute cuisine where you have to live by this unwritten set of rules. You don't need to. You need to come in and have a good time. That's the only thing we expect of people.
Well, here's another one I want to come in and enjoy and have fun with is your panzanella with crispy pig's ear. I love pig's ear.
I love pig's ear, too.
But it's hard to get unless you deal with...
You can certainly go to Asian markets and get it anytime.
Uh-huh. Okay.
Yeah, they're around all the time there. I mean, I think my favorite, the intro... Let me find it in the book real quick. It is the party tripe on soft polenta.
Oh, I saw that. I loved that, yeah.
That one was funny, I think. I'll
read
it.
That's funny.
It's the next time you feel like throwing a raging party for all your tripe-loving friends, this is a dish for you. And that's all I need to read. The first line of the intro.
Yeah, you got... There are lots of recipes like that. This is a really jolly book.
It's a wonderful book. Peter said he sounds like he's having so much fun, and that's what you said.
And Chef Ethan, I think you must be an awfully jolly fellow.
Try to have a good time.
Now,
good
is there a single website where people can get information about all your restaurants?
Sure. Our mother website is EthanStollRestaurants.com.
And let's make sure we spell that. Ethan, listeners, you'll get Stoll is pronounced just like it sounds, but it's S-T...
Well, it's EthanStowell, restaurants.com.
Not S. No S on the Stoll.
Stoll, Stowell.
Okay.
Yeah.
And the book, listeners, is... Ethan Stoll's New Italian Kitchen, and I think it's going to open up a whole world of creativity and deliciousness for everybody who gets a hold of it, and it certainly has for me, Ethan.
All right, well, good, thanks.
And listen up, because we're going to come out and see you. We're long overdue to get to the Northwest, and I can't wait to meet you in person. I'm sure we'd have a wonderfully jolly time.
I'm sure we will. Let me know when you're coming out.
We will, Ethan. Thank you so much. And, yeah, I'm dying for these dishes.
All right, good, thanks.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
As the English or Irish might say, Ethan sounds like a fine fellow. And we're following him up with a fine lady.
Yes.
I mean, would we call Jean Anderson the mother and father of all cookbook authors?
Well, she's sure.
She certainly produced lots of them, and she's got a delicious one for the day and for the season.
Yeah, especially for the season. And with an interesting title, right?
It's Falling Off the Bone, and it's dedicated to one-pot meals, braisers mostly. And some really fascinating conversations that we had about that, including our own efforts in the same direction recently. So it's not just about Jean, it's also about the whole concept of one-pot meals and braising instead of more modern techniques, and I think you're going to enjoy the conversation.
Well, it's just exactly the right weather for Jean Anderson and her book called Falling Off the Bone. Hi, Jean.
Hey, Anne, how are you?
My husband's got on a stew binge, actually, right now.
Good timing.
Yeah, it is.
Well, I was looking for a lamb stew recipe, and Anne said, well, this book's got about 50 of them. I said, well, that'll really help me, since I'm just trying to squeeze this lamb stew making into watching Tiger Woods lose a golf tournament and watching the Cowboys play the Indianapolis Colts.
Well.
And doing much more important things than worrying about reading recipes.
But you have plenty of wonderful recipes in this book. And, Jean, I'm always amazed. How many books have you written?
Oh, dear, Aunt. To be honest, I haven't really counted them. I mean, I've been at it for a very long time. And, I know that it's more than 20, but I'm not sure how many more. And I hate to sound like a hack, but I really have been. The very first cookbook that I wrote, I think, was published in 1965. And believe it or not, it is still in print.
Which one was that?
That was The Art of American Indian Cooking, which Doubleday published.
Holy Moses.
And it's gone through several incarnations, and it's now in paperback.
Oh, my,
but
I've never seen
still
that
available.
One. See, I've never seen
so,
that one
So
at all.
Jean Anderson's a bit of an institution, huh?
Well, maybe so, but I have worked very long and hard, and I will say that my first job in New York was in the test kitchen of a ladies' home journal, and I realized then and there how desperately important it is that recipes be tested. And that is one of the things that I do always do. And I'm, known as a person whose recipes work.
Oh, that's great.
But that experience, I will tell you, was just extremely valuable. And if I do remember early on at the Journal, I was, I don't know if you remember the series we did called How America Lived. And there were always ancillary pieces. And often I would be sent out to interview the food cooks so that that part would fit into the portfolio. And one of the first ones I did was a woman out in California, and her favorite fruit nut bread was a cranberry nut bread, and I tested it. It was perfect in the kitchen, and everybody loved it. But somehow, going through the editorial process, baking powder got left.
Oh, yeah, that always happens,
Well, what the Journal did was make me reimburse everybody who had a failed recipe, and boy, that teaching very fast, out of my own pocket.
Wait, did you read As Always, Julia?
Yes.
Well, did you see her early memories of writing for the Ladies' Home Journal?
Well, no, that I missed, because, I was no longer at the Journal when Julia...
She just references that you got a sense of the reputation and the direction, and I think she did some test chapters.
Well, perhaps she did. I left the Journal in year 64.
Oh, that was afterwards.
Yeah, to start a travel magazine for Look magazine that was called Venture, the Traveler's World. Huh. And I was one of the founding editors of that magazine.
Wow.
Now, the reason I'm bringing this up just now is because the book we're talking about, I don't know whether we mentioned its name even, or Falling Off the Bone, is indeed a book of hearty braise stew kinds of recipes. One of the things I found out by trial and error and had confirmed by a brilliant chef in Cleveland called Michael Simon, and I haven't read your book all the way through, so I'm not sure if you say the same thing, but the best thing you can do with a stew is make it today and not eat it till tomorrow.
Oh, absolutely. I agree with that. And I say that many times.
Great. Because I made my...
Because the flavors really get to be together better overnight in the refrigerator.
Sure.
And it's so many of these stews are elegant enough for small dinner parties. And if you're a nervous Nelly hostess, make it a day before, let it sit in the fridge overnight. Next day, just heat it up and then add a vegetable or something, and you're ready to go.
Well, these are certainly cold weather dishes.
And, yes, they certainly
and
are.
It's also the right approach to cooking meat. And you do cover beef, lamb, pig, and veal.
Veal, yeah, the four basic meats.
Right,
yes.
But it comes now, you're to use, these are cooking methods for and recipes for economy cuts of meat.
Yes, absolutely. These are the tough cuts, the bony cuts, and people laugh, but you know, I took a meat cutting class.
I read that.
And one of the things that the professor told us early on, and I've never forgotten it, is that the tender cuts, you know, which come from the loin and the rib, will never be more tender than they are raw. And the whole point there is to preserve as much of that original tenderness. It's totally the reverse for the well-exercised parts, and these are the ones that I talk about, the shoulder, the shank.
The leg of lamb, for example, right?
Yeah,
well, he did that last night.
All of this sinew and all of the gristle that's in this meat, if you cook it low and slow, turns to gelatin. And that's why these cuts are so succulent and so deeply flavorful.
Well, now, would you please explain to Anne that the only reason that I cooked with leg of lamb is I couldn't get shoulder and neck because Whole Foods doesn't stock it, so...
Really? Well, the one here certainly does.
Yeah, well...
Peter, I do have at the back of the book a list of online sources, companies that will pack and, you know, properly and, you know, in ice packs or whatever, and you can order stuff online and have it sent right to your door.
Could I ask one question
here
before... Whatever possessed you, I mean, now it would not be surprising, but when you did this, what possessed you to take a meat cutting course?
I just thought that it was a good idea. It was an elective course, and I was a food science nutrition major at Cornell. And I thought, you know, I think this will probably, you know, stand me in good stead someday.
Well, it did, obviously.
Yeah, and to be honest, it was probably one of the most valuable courses that I took. And hours and hours and hours of chemistry. You know, I know the basics, but I don't really use chemistry the way that meat cutting course.
But, you know, it just wasn't done, especially, you know, by women in college in those days.
Well, no, but it was not that I was going to be a butcher. It was to teach me so that as a food person, mm-hmm. I would really know. And the thing that I do find now, which is somewhat alarming, is the mislabeling. You know, everything now in the supermarkets is pre-cut, packaged, and so who knows what you've got.
What you got. Tell us about your final exam in this course, because I thought that was good.
Well, yeah, you have to picture a room that's about the size of a small gymnasium, and then these tables are set up end, snaking all around this room. They're covered with butcher paper, and on top are, I don't know, more than 100 anonymous cuts of meat. And what we had to do was to go around and identify each one of these cuts. Beef, is it pork, is it lamb? Then the particular cut, or the part of the animal, you know, whence it comes, and then the particular cut. But not only that, is this Chicago cut, or is this Kansas City cut, or is this New York cut?
I wouldn't be
we
able
had to
do
tell
that.
Whether it was prime or...
See, I couldn't have took. I couldn't have
well,
done
it
that.
Well, it was a horrific exam, I will tell you.
No, you passed it, but did you...
I did pass,
What did you get? What grade?
But it was tough.
What was your grade?
Well, you know, to be honest, I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't think that I, you know,
all right, well, we won't.
Made a fool of myself.
My mother always used to roast a cut she called a salmon cut.
Yeah, I never understood and, what that
a is. Salmon cut.
Yeah, what is that?
Best we could figure out is it's actually a tri-tip, and it's really not the kind of meat.
What animal are we talking
beef,
about?
Beef.
Beef.
Oh,
beef.
Okay.
And she cooked it till it was really dead.
Well, I wonder if that might have been the sirloin tip. I don't know, that's a triangular cut, but I have no idea.
I think that's what it was. So, I think that's what it was. We also had this wonderful stuff, which is lamb, called best end of neck.
How funny.
So they take a piece of neck and they cut it sort of like chops.
Wow.
But the bones don't meet.
Wow.
Because they're not structurally supposed to be like that.
Well, yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah, when we lived in D.C., we went to the French Market for a butcher, and they could tell us what everybody ate. And I could always remember Teddy Kennedy had for breakfast every morning 2-tooth lamb chops. Now, what are those?
Heaven.
Well, they're not quite mutton, so they're not quite lamb, and they're not quite mutton. In Australia, it's called tutus.
Yeah, I had not heard that term.
I think in England they're called hoggets, but I'm not certain.
Huh.
But they weren't sold as lamb, but they didn't make it as rams either.
Well, you know,
when I was growing up in the South, very few people around here ate lamb, and we did. I mean, both of my parents were from the Midwest. So we were considered really sort of weird because we ate lamb.
Yeah,
I'm just tell one very fast story. I remember one night a school chum came home after, you know, school to play and then stayed for dinner. And my mother served lamb chops. And she said, "Oh, Miss Anderson, those are just the best steak I ever had." And mother said, "Well, Nolene, these actually were lamb chops." And she just was panicked. She said, "Oh, we hate lamb." And mother said, "Have you ever eaten lamb?" And she said, well, no, because we hate it.
but that was
sort of the attitude.
But you just did, huh?
Back then.
Now, another characteristic of this book is, needless to say, your recipes are gorgeous and fascinating. But it's not just a romp through the different animals. You use global themes. I mean,
Well, it's because, as I said, I, like you, travel all over the world. And wherever I go, one of the first things I do is to hit the local bookstore, and I riffle through to see what local, you know, cookbooks there are, and I've got sort of a vast collection. But then also whatever restaurants I eat in, you know, out comes the steno pad, and I'm just constantly scribbling notes. And that's another thing that we were taught to do at the Ladies' Home Journal was to crack recipes. And once a week, we were supposed to go to a different New York restaurant and order sort of high on the hog, as we say, and then make notes about the dishes that we had eaten.
Uh-huh.
And then back at the magazine in the test kitchens, we would try to develop these recipes. And then, of course, many appeared in the magazine. And, of course, we would always credit the restaurant and the chef.
Uh-huh.
But we were trying to be a little higher end than, you know, McCall's or Good Housekeeping or, the competition.
Uh-huh. Now, what was the recipe that Peter was quite taken by, a Sicilian lamb recipe?
Yes, yeah, it's a Sicilian lamb stew. It's interesting. It had raisins in it.
Well, that's typical.
And a variety of other things.
Yeah, this is a holdover of the days, I think, of the Saracens. I know I've spent a fair amount of time in Sicily, and I've really been interested in their combinations of, like, dried fruit
agrodolce.
And also with different, you know, cuts of meat.
It's agrodolce.
I'm sorry.
It's agrodolce is what it's called.
Well, yes, absolutely.
Because that was my background. I was raised Sicilian.
You were raised Sicilian?
Yeah. So,
well,
I mean,
well, agrodolce, yes, absolutely.
It was
really
unique.
And I find
unique.
That really fascinating. But some of the stews, the lamb stews also that I've, you know, eaten in Greece, mainland Greece and various of the islands, and also Turkey and other parts of the Middle East. But it really is a global collection, but there are also many, many, many American recipes, including many from my own family. There's my grandmother's Illinois beef stew, which is really a good one, or beef soup, I think it is. It's a vast collection, and the thing, you know, my father was a college professor, and I, you know, we didn't have much money, and so my mother always cooked soups and stews and pot roasts, and they're virtually dinners in a dish. And once everything's in the pot, they pretty much cook themselves.
Right.
Now, what are a couple of your favorites, Jean?
Oh, well, my party favorite.
They're all your children, I understand.
Well, I have to say that my party favorite really is probably ossobuco. I think it's a very, very elegant dish. It is an easy dish, and it certainly is one that is best made a day ahead, kept in the refrigerator. And you heat it up and just add either risotto or rice or green vegetable, and you've got a very elegant meal, I think.
I love it. I absolutely love it.
And what I also did was a slow cooker version using pork shank that was inspired, my recipe was inspired by one of the really good chefs here who was, you know, a best in the Southeast beard chef named Ben Barker.
How long we know Ben Barker?
Ben is really terrific.
Yeah, in Magnolia Grill in Durham. Yeah, and I thought that that was brilliant, you know, to make ossobuco out of pork.
Yeah, Chef Wina, who actually is Portuguese, does it out of turkey legs.
Really?
Yeah, and I mean, it looks like ossobuco almost when he does it.
Well, except the bone surely is a lot smaller.
Oh well, yeah, but I mean, he uses the thigh.
Yeah.
So it's but it looks.
Did you get any marrow out of turkey bone?
I don't think so.
No,
yeah.
I think
so
it's
to me, that's one of the great delicacies of the world.
Oh, me too.
I get really mad if they cut the bones wrong.
Yeah.
so you can't get at it.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree with you totally. Yeah. But, you know, one thing I would love to add, I take a lot of these the Harvard, you know, medical newsletter, and the one that I got from Tufts just this week, it's the December issue of their health and nutrition letter, does a special report on meat cookery. And it said, this to me was a surprise, it said that meats that are thrown on the grill at too high a temperature or stay too long or those that are fried too hot are really, well, we knew that this
carcinogenic
produced carcinogens, but now they are saying also puts you at much greater risk for arthritis, for heart disease, and this to me was a true surprise, diabetes. And they go on to say that low and slow, braising and stewing are the most healthful ways to cook any meat. Book is all about
it is
low and slow.
The one thing I can't get my way around is the fat that comes with these kinds of dishes. You can even see it glistening.
Well, there are a lot of easy remedies for that, number one. But first let me say that pork fat, as you probably know, is now considered to be largely unsaturated. And in fact, this the Asaba pork, and this is pork from the descendants of those hogs that De Soto brought in 500 years ago, they are calling these hogs four-legged olive trees because that fat at room temperature is almost liquid. The most brittle fat, of course, is lamb or mutton fat, which is tallow. It was used for making candles in the old days. But the thing is, first of all, if you cook these stews or braises and then refrigerate them overnight, it could not be easier just to lift off the fat because it solidifies on top.
Absolutely. No,
so you get rid of most of it.
Yeah. I've bought every device imaginable to skim the fat, and none of them work.
Well, I tell you a couple of tricks. One thing that I have done is to put ice cubes in the zipper bags, plastic bags, and then sort of drag the bag across the surface, and the fat will congeal on the bag. And then you're not watering down the dish because the ice cubes are inside.
Right. So anyway, the answer is cook it yesterday.
Cook it yesterday, refrigerate it overnight, and heat it up right before you serve it.
And that's exactly what we're going to do tonight. And this is a wonderful book. I knew that I better make up my own recipe because yours are all so good I wouldn't have known which one to cook.
Well, you say eeny, meeny, miny, moe.
Is that what you do? Okay.
Well, I hope you do. You know, I do think there's a lot of good eating in this book.
I think so, too.
Falling off the bone. And let me just add one thing, if I may. I do have a website, and I do call myself the Recipe Doc because I was for years sort of the hotline for the Food Network and also Gourmet.
Sure, go ahead, Gene. That's
so
great.
You know, if anybody has any cooking problem, let me know, and I'll try to solve it. It's www.GeneAndersonCooks.com.
That's
Gene,
great.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We hope that winter in North Carolina is kinder to you than it started off to be.
Well, we've already had snow, so we'll see.
It's snowing right outside.
But regardless, we'll all be fine because we'll make stews and we'll stay warm and cozy throughout the season.
Wonderful, Peter.
Thank you so much, Gene.
Thank you.
Yeah, Gene, and we'll talk to you next about your Portuguese book.
Okie doke, sounds good.
Okay. Thank you.
Take care. Bye.
Bye.
And now a break, and I guess it's probably long overdue.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Are you going to say welcome back to Lou?
Yeah, well, sure. I mean, you said
okay.
welcome back. We're
both welcoming everybody back, and this next story is really fascinating life story.
Oh, yeah, you like this.
Of someone who started out as a mathematician and decided it was better to be a pastry chef. So see if you can figure that one out. Well, you won't have to because you can listen to Joanne Chang explain it to us.
Joanne Chang has probably one of the more fascinating stories we've ever heard about how she ended up as a pastry chef and restaurateur after a stint earning a degree at Harvard in, what was it, Joanne?
It was in applied mathematics and economics.
Well, maybe the economics helps.
And both of them told you that there was no way you could make a living in the bakery business.
Exactly. Right. That's the one thing I learned.
I have to tell you, I have a secret for your continued success.
And that is?
When you open F4, you open it in my native land of England.
Ah!
Because it would be such a wonderful success. After all, what can be wrong with someone whose motto is eat dessert first?
As I told you, I don't have a sweet tooth, and so I was really, that was an oddball out, and have been the whole time Peter and I have been married, which is quite a long time, because everybody just got through the main meal to reach the dessert buffet.
Right.
And, you know, and they didn't understand that this was not something that everybody had this gun to the, for sweets.
I was famous in my family for always being the one who had two pieces of everything. I don't do that anymore, but your passion for baking is, can you shorten the story just a little bit? I mean, it's such a lovely story. People should buy this book to read just that part of it because it's so inspiring, but give us the elevator version.
Sure. Well, basically, I didn't grow up with sweets. I come from a traditional Chinese family, and we just didn't have dessert. So when I was growing up and starting to spend time at my friends' houses and in school, you know, at the cafeteria, all of a sudden I was introduced to a whole new world that I knew nothing about. Like maybe sometimes we would have a plate of oranges after dinner, and that was it. So I think I naturally have a sweet tooth that hadn't really been paid any attention until I was about maybe 10 or 11 was when I started to kind of venture out into my friends' world, seeing what they enjoyed. And that kind of sparked the whole thing, where I just became obsessed with pastry. It's really obsessed with trying to try as many things as I could, reading about it all the time, buying cookbooks, buying magazines, staring at the bakery case in the supermarket. But it wasn't anything that I planned to do professionally. In fact, I studied math and economics at Harvard and planned to go on and work in business, which I did do for 2 years after graduation. And at the end of my second year as a management consultant, I just thought to myself, my gosh, I have loved to cook and I have loved to bake my whole life. I'm going to try it. And I tried it for a year, and I continued to find jobs that just taught me so much in baking and in cooking that I never went back into business. I mean, except for to open eventually a bakery.
Now, it must have been fun during those teenage years and even when you were in the world of business to be your friend. I'm sure you were always baking special treats for people. In fact, in your book you say that you certainly did that.
Exactly. I mean, when you bake, most of the time, you know, you bake a cake or you bake cookies, a dozen, two dozen cookies. There's no way you can eat it all yourself. So, of course, I would share some with my family, and then whatever my family didn't eat, I would bring to school with friends. And then later on, when I was in college and was baking, then what ended up happening was I would just give most of it to my friends. So it was definitely something that I think I became very popular because of that.
Yeah, well, we keep running into bakers, I guess you call it, who had that same thing, like Sandra Bullock's sister, Jazine.
Oh, yes, of course.
Yeah, and she just kept cooking as therapy to escape the rat race that was Hollywood. And, of course, she couldn't eat it all, so she started giving it away. And then, of course, it caught on, and she realized she could do this. And then we just interviewed the fat witch, a brownie mm-hmm. lady, and she did it to escape Wall Street's pressures. And she would bring all of her brownies onto her office on the trading floor, and everybody would gobble up these things. So I mean, I think that it's a natural outgrowth of if you enjoy baking, you've got to have people who enjoy eating it.
Exactly. And that's exactly what I did when I was working as a management consultant. I was baking all the time, and I was bringing everything extra to work. And, you know, finally someone said, wow, I have a baby shower or a bridal shower that I need to go to. Could you bake me some things? Can I buy them from you? And I think that kind of planted the seed. I was like, oh, wow, people will actually pay me to do what I do voluntarily for free because I love to do it.
Turns out pastry's pretty complicated, isn't it? This book, you've been very careful, you say, in the book, to scale back the recipes so that they're something that can be done successfully at home, but the process of creating the things that you put on the shelf and display and that you sell in your three flour shops are a little bit more complicated.
You're right. I did have that as one of my challenges in writing the book. What we do at the bakery, both the actual baking and just the logistics of keeping the case and the counter stocked with wonderful pastries, that can be complicated. Some of the recipes are a little bit more involved. But that was the big challenge in the book, was trying to take all of these recipes and bring them down to a home cook's level so that you could recreate what we do here at the bakery every day. And that's been one of the great pleasures of having the book published, is that now people are baking from it and sending me pictures, and every day I get emails. Oh, it's amazing.
Oh, how wonderful. Well, the book is worth price of admission just for the tips at the front.
Oh, thank you.
Because some of them are obvious, some of them are far from obvious, and you just present them all matter-of-factly as if, this is just something you should know. And, if you know that, that's fine. If you don't know it, then make a note of it. Like baking the pie crust first, for example. What you call blind baking. Boy, that sounds really scientific, huh? It's almost like a term from economics.
No, but blind baking makes all the difference. I can't tell you the number of pies. When I finally started to discover the world of sweets and I tried pies in restaurants and in bakeries, I was always struck by how many times the bottom crust was gummy.
Yeah.
Or wet, or just undone.
Yeah, and terrible.
And it's so easy to take. I mean, it's a little bit of extra time. Very easy to simply bake the crust beforehand and then fill it. You know, that's something that a lot of professional bakers know, but I know a lot of home bakers don't know. And so I wanted to teach people at home kind of the tricks that we have in bakeries and restaurants that we just assume everybody knows. And so that was one of the things I tried to share, was all these things that I just do by second nature.
You know, I can tell you a horror story. My mother was the baker. I've never baked anything. And I was in Australia with Peter, and I decided I would bake him a strawberry pie. So I tried to envision what actually my mother used to do. And I do remember that she would prick the crust.
Mm-hmm.
Except I didn't realize that after pricking the crust, she would then bake it before filling it. That was a mess.
Well, you also went to the supermarket there trying to buy Crisco, which is a product that doesn't exist. Frozen strawberries, which is another product that doesn't exist on the grocery shelves there. Now, chances are, in this modern world by now, they probably have both Crisco and frozen strawberries.
Yeah, but in any event, you would not...
35 years ago, they didn't.
You would not prick the crust and then put a wet... bottom. That was very...
I think our daughter-in-law still doesn't know that. Jen, I hope you're not listening.
It's the thought that counts.
Yeah, now tell the story of your sticky buns.
Oh, yes. So we have been selling sticky buns at the bakery since we opened just over 10 years ago. It's a personal favorite of mine, and they've always been very, very popular.
Yeah, they're popular. I've never understood why people are so crazy. There's a private women's club in Pittsburgh that they're... signature roll at lunchtime, and this comes like with the main meal, is sticky buns.
Really?
Yes. Very strange.
Wow.
And didn't eat hers. Anyway, to continue with the story of the sticky buns.
We've been making about 2 to 3 dozen sticky buns a day since we opened, and one day the Food Network called me and said, we are interested in having you film a pilot episode of a show that we're thinking of starting on the Food Network called The Science of Sweets. Baking takes a lot of, very precise, and there's a lot of science behind it, and we want to showcase that. And we know you have a math background, and would you be interested in filming the pilot episode? So I said, absolutely. It sounded like a great idea. I loved the idea of a whole show that would talk about the science that goes behind baking. So the Food Network crew came up to Boston, spent a full day with me filming what I thought was the pilot episode of a new show called The Science of Sweets. They said, we need one more day where you're going to teach people how to make sticky buns as part of the show. Can you do this in one of your bakeries? And I said, sure. So the next day, the whole crew came to one of the bakeries, and we filmed me teaching a group of people how to make sticky buns. And as I'm in the middle of teaching this group of people, I hear this big round of applause, and I look up, and Bobby Flay walks in. Now, Bobby Flay, you know, very famous celebrity chef, does a show called Throwdown with Bobby Flay, which I believe is one of the most popular shows on the Food Network. And in this show, he challenges local chefs at their specialty, and he had come to challenge me and sticky buns.
Silly boy, silly boy.
Exactly, silly boy.
He should have done better.
I was totally stunned. I hadn't watched the show before, so I didn't really know what was going on. And it happens all within about 2 or 3 hours. He had already prepared his sticky buns off-site, and he brought them in. And I was in the middle of preparing mine. So we baked them, served them to the group of people that were there. They had the Food Network brought in two judges to judge our sticky buns side by side in a blind taste test. And at the end of the show, they declare the winner. And neither he nor I knew who was going to win because it's entirely blind. It's not staged at all. And the very last couple minutes of the show, the judges raised my hand as the winner, which I was very, very glad for because I was so nervous. It all happened so fast. You don't really know what's going on. And then all of a sudden, standing there with judges and the cameras are on you, and then they declared sticky bun number one, which is mine, the winner.
Congratulations.
Thank you. Thank you. It was quite an experience. It was really, really fun, and it really went, we went from making about 2 to 3 dozen a day to times we'll make 200 to 300 a day. I mean, it's just insane how much people clamor for these now that they've seen them on the show.
Well, the photographs are gorgeous.
So, here's the story, listeners. If you have a chef friend or someone who thinks they're a great cook coming to your house, can challenge them to a contest cooking sticky buns or anything else that's in this wonderful book, and you'll be sure to win. Because all the answers for how to do the preparation and all the wonderful, all the ingredients and all the science behind it are all there.
Right. Exactly.
And they're pretty basic recipes. I mean, these are the things, the sweets that the American public turns to when they want a chocolate eclair, a cupcake, right, an apple pie, a sticky bun, whatever.
Hmm? Yeah, a new tiramisu.
There's a new tiramisu
that you invented, right? You invented. So.
Well, I took an old, I took what people thought of as tiramisu, and I tried to make it a little bit more modern, just lightening it up a little bit. I'm using real chocolate, not a lot of cocoa powder, which can sometimes taste dusty. And just, I mean, it's new just in that I really tried to modernize it to ours because I think in the past people did like their sweets a lot sweeter. And one of the things about flour and about my personal taste is that I don't love things super, super sweet. I just don't find as much enjoyment out of them.
Yeah, I don't like them either.
Now, do you have a blog or anything like that, a resource page that people can go to if they have the book but they sort of get stuck?
Oh, absolutely. We've got a couple resources. You can go to the website, flourbakery.com, and on the homepage, there's a link to my email, and I field questions all day long from people who
do you really? Well, how do you have time?
I do. You know, most of the time, the questions are pretty quick, and I wasn't sure whether or not I should do this, but I just felt like there are so many people who want to bake but who hesitate because of some little issue. Like, they just want to know, ooh, what does this mean? Ooh, what does that mean? And I thought, I'm just going to put it out there and see what happens. And it's been great. I mean, it's not, most people, I would say 99.9% of people, they're not looking for a huge, long explanation. They just want to know, you say to use this much yeast. I thought it should be this much. Is there a reason why? Explain quickly, you know, why I use this much yeast in the bread. And then they say thank you, and then we move on. And it's just, I think it's nice to be able to connect with people who are reading the book so that they can feel like basically a continuation of what the book is, which is I want to be there by your side helping you with this recipe, which is how all the recipes are written. There's a chance that there might be a question in your head that's not answered by the recipe, so then I want you to be able to contact me, and then I'll answer your question.
Well, Joanne, this is a wonderful book. You have a fascinating life story, and thank you so much for sharing it with us and for providing this landmark book in how to cook desserts like a professional at home.
I so want that apple pie.
Thank you so much for having me. This is such a pleasure.
Oh, thanks, Joanne. I hope to see you in Boston sometime.
Please do. I would love that.
And now another break.
Podcasting services for On the Menu Radio are provided by ASP Station, www.aspstation.net.
Welcome back. Well, if moving from being a mathematician and then a consultant to being a pastry chef is an unusual transition, next interview is an even more unusual transition from Wall Street trader to
a brownie baker
in New York City. So,
and what a great packaging it is. And here's fat. which...
Yeah, here's a story of...
Patricia Helding, how did you get from being a Wall Street trader to being a brownie maker?
Well, one of the things, from being on Wall Street, one of the things that helped me relax in the evening was going home and baking. And I started baking brownies, so they were my favorite thing. And I would bring them in to work the next day. Obviously, I couldn't eat them all. And people went wild for them. And I was trying out a lot of recipes. Finally hit one that I really liked. And at a certain point, I decided to trade in an apron and an oven mitt.
But a bit of sugar high is really exactly what a top Wall Street trader really needs, huh?
Of course. Just make yourself spit a little bit more.
Yeah, get even more hyper if you can.
Exactly.
Well, the name of your bakery and your company is Fat Witch Brownies, and I have to tell you, I just think it's the cleverest name. You can tell us that story if you want. And also, the packaging is wonderful. Your fat witch appears on all your cards. I love the square box of the samples that you sent with the little small bites of the brownies in it. And you sell 2,500 of these a day?
We do almost 2,500 a day. We bake 2,500 a day.
Okay, so you named this company after a colleague who pigged out on your brownies.
Yeah, she had a laugh just like a witch, and she would swoop in when I would bring the brownies in, and I'd say, careful, you're going to be a fat witch. And she would just laugh just like a witch.
Now, is she still a trader, and is she a customer?
She has moved on also.
Is she a customer?
Yes, she is. We're still friends.
That's great.
Yes.
So you are really surreptitiously creating a demand for your product by sneaking it into people's diet, so that now of course they can't do without them.
Exactly. And actually, the trading floor, a lot of those people are still customers. They were my first, and a lot of them still are.
Now, the subtitle for your book is Brownies, Blondies, and Bars from New York's legendary Fat Witch Bakery. I guess we should point out that you are in New York, and you actually have a bakery?
We actually have a space, a retail space, in Manhattan, in Chelsea Market.
What does it look like?
Hmm?
Oh, you're in Chelsea Market.
We are in Chelsea Market.
Oh,
yes.
With Amy's Bread, my buddy
with
Amy?
With Amy's Bread, absolutely.
Oh, okay. I haven't seen her in a couple of years.
Yeah.
Yeah, we usually would make a detour to see her.
Well, we went through the Chelsea Market place, but I think we must have been short of time or something like that.
Well, this was, yeah. No, we haven't been.
We didn't stop for a brownie either, but that's something.
Well, hopefully you'll stop and get a sample. We almost always have samples out.
Now, I liked the brownie, the original brownie that you did, but a lot of people have their own special favorites, right?
Yes, almost everybody. A lot of people have their own way of making brownies, and almost everybody remembers baking with their mom and so forth. But, you know, we use Ghirardelli chocolate, which gives it a slightly different taste. And a lot of people like our blondies also. They would take a blondie over a brownie.
Well, I never knew you could do so many things with brownies. You have this over-the-top section, and I know that's not what delicious decadence you call it.
Yes.
And I never even thought. First of all, who would top a brownie with icing?
I know. You know, I'm not. That was a really hard decision, and most of the time we don't do it in the store, but people do like icing. So we included some. I mean, like, for New Year's Eve, we always do a champagne icing.
Oh, wow.
On the brownie. So I included that sort of thing.
Well, we had a dinner party, and somebody was baking brownies to bring them. And we had a company send us a sample, also from Vermont, of a goat's milk
it's called fat,
caramel.
Fat toad goat's milk caramel.
So the Fat Witch and Fat Toad should get together because this caramel topping. It's fabulous.
It's absolutely wonderful.
Goat milk.
Fat Toad is
fat
the name.
Toad.
That's the name
okay.
of the company.
Fat Toad.
I'm sure if you Google them, you'll find them. And if you have any trouble, just let us know and we'll put
I
you
will.
In touch. But it's it would
the
be
the caramel topping is fabulous.
Yeah, it would be an alternate to the other icings that you mentioned and would go really well.
Yeah, she's the caramel witch here.
it's really a favorite taste of Americans.
Oh, it's all of a sudden it's like having some kind of major revival with the salted caramels like Fran does
but it's something about doing it with goat milk.
Yeah,
I just had I don't know whether it was from them, but we were in a pop up store
next to the Gap on Fifth Avenue called Cool Hunting, and they've taken all local things, and we're lucky enough to be one of the local New York things. And they had a goat milk caramel.
And it comes in a little jar and a big jar?
It comes, I would say, 6-ounce jar, and they also put scotch in it.
Oh, well, I don't think these guys are doing scotch. Anyway, it would be a good
connection. I would love to get to know them.
But you got two, the interesting thing is you got two ways of going with Fat Witch. You can buy the book and make your own, which is longer, but probably in the long run less expensive.
Oh, yes.
Or you can just indulge immediately. And if you're not in New York City and you can't go to the Chelsea Market to get some, how can you lay your hands on some in distribution?
We've got a website.
Okay.
So you can go to the website and, and have it shipped. Are there places you can actually go get one?
There are in New York City, but because our brownies have no preservative, we don't sell to California or really out of our area.
Okay, but there are places in New York where you can buy them as well.
Yes.
Because I think most people, if they want a brownie, they want it now.
Or
5 minutes ago. So
that's a good point. Well, I always think it's a good idea to have a cookbook. And we also have a mix where you can make them.
Oh, okay. Really? So it's sort of a no-fail.
It's a no-fail. And because I own a bakery, whenever I give a dinner party, I always forget to bring home brownies.
I
am always scrambling. So I usually have a mix at home, or I'm opening up the book, and I use it myself. Okay, what do I have in the cabinet that I can put together?
Well, you couldn't have made it more simple for people to make these brownies. All they need is an 8x8-inch baking thing.
For the cookbook, it's a 9x9.
I mean, 9x9 baking pan.
Every recipe has been adjusted for a 9x9-inch square pan.
I mean, I just think it's fabulous. And you show throughout the book ways to make these into really classy gifts.
It's one of the things that actually the editor wanted us to do. She said, you're known for your packaging. And I thank you very much. And so we went back and redid some, got the photographer back, and added those later.
Well, now I think there's only one piece of information left that we need, and that's the website. And if on the website, there's also a place you can find out where you can get some in your neighborhood.
I don't have a place on our website where you can get them. It's kind of a moving target.
Okay.
You will have. I know you will.
But, and also that every store sort of orders different things because we have 8 different kinds.
Okay, I got you.
And so that I thought about it, and maybe I should be doing that. But our website is fatwitch.com.
Very good. Well, I think it's a delightful read as well, because you're a very witty, funny person. So.
Well, thank you. And I just did this one last thing, because I know you have such an international audience.
Yeah.
I was so impressed with that I would like the audience to know that brownies are one of the few all-American pastries, things that we've invented here.
Well, Peter's mother, who was a real dessert freak, she used to talk about freakum. She used to freak out when my mother would get her brownies when she came to visit us from the UK. Peter's English.
Oh, yes, yes.
I read that.
Yeah.
We're a sweet tooth nation, and it's really amazing that the English did not invent brownies. It's actually quite possible. I suspect that George Washington stole the recipe from Lord Cornwallis.
I think he stole gingerbread.
I think he probably stole brownies as well.
Okay.
And we wish you tremendous success, and we hope you make more.
And I'll look forward to seeing you sometime.
I hope so. Let me know when you're in New York.
Okay.
Thank you so much.
Patricia, thank you, and good luck.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Well, listeners, we hope you've had as good a time listening to us as we've had talking to you, and we'll see you again, same time, same place next week.
Bye-bye.